This is a continuation of the oral history interview with Emeritus Professor of Spanish, Juan Carlos Temprano, on March 21st, 2007. When we left off last time, we were talking about your arriving here from Texas and how you had found the student body, some of the cultural differences. I want to ask you now what the department was like when you came, who some of the significant colleagues were, and in your time teaching here, how the department changed.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I came, I found a department which obviously they have a few superstars, but mostly it was composed of people who originally have obtained their PhDs from Wisconsin, from Madison.
Oh.
So it was basically an all boys, to use that expression, department. Things were done in such a way, in a way that was the tradition, and nobody questioned anything. And it was run basically by two or three members of the department. There were two or three major scholars who didn't get involved at all in the administration and the policies and the ideology, let's say, of the department. So at the very beginning it was a little hard because I came from the University of Texas, where we have in that department, the Spanish department in Texas, a rather, at least on paper, very democratic system. The executive committee there, for instance, was representative of all ranks, and the people were elected by their constituents, by their peers. So there was so many assistant professors, so many associate professors, so many full professors elected, some by their own peers, some at large. When I came here, the executive committee was obviously the tenure people. But it was run almost like a family. Okay. For instance, the first thing that surprised me, it was the fact that there was no agenda or no minutes.
Really?
So immediately I raised a question. And it was not taken very lightly and very gladly. So eventually, by pushing and pushing and pushing, after one semester or two, we began to have minutes.
Oh.
But literally, I know there were minutes before, but those minutes were taken by somebody who I didn't particularly know in that moment, and those minutes were not seen by anybody. In fact, when I finally convinced them to have minutes, and they were given to us, at the same meeting, they were taken back from us. They were not allowed us to give it, which was, to me, rather surprising.
How interesting.
Yeah. Well, it was the way it was done before. So eventually, things moved along, and
Were you a primary force for change?
In that particular moment, yes. Uh-huh. And I requested to see the minutes of the past with only with one objective, to try to create some kind of a booklet, handbook, or rules and regulations and policies of the department and the basis of decision taken in the past, which they were recorded. They just not, they were not seen. So therefore, every time that we have a meeting, decisions were made a little ad hoc, not necessarily in view of what has transpired or has been approved, uh-huh, but by that body. Okay, so I was able to do it to that, and that was accepted with certain resistance, but eventually it was that.
Huh.
That didn't create the first years for me here, they were hard, because I got to become very close friends with some members, but other members, they didn't in particular look at me
fondly.
Fondly, let's put it this way. Okay?
Now, so, I've forgotten, did you come here with tenure?
I came with tenure.
Okay, yeah. So you're a full professor?
No, I was an associate professor.
Associate professor. Okay.
So, associate professor, I became associate professor in 5 years, but then, because of this, and because I probably, in retrospect, I used way too much of my, too many of my energies into the administration of the department and into the teaching, my so-called, my publications suffer. So it took me almost 9 years to become full professor from the moment I was here. Yeah.
Do you think if you had it to do over again, you'd do it differently?
Or Knowing myself, I would not do it differently. But from the practical point of view, it would have been much better to go along with the flow and use my time for myself. Yeah.
So you really came into this university with a good attitude of being a university citizen.
Well, good attitude, I was on the basis of what I have learned at Princeton and in Texas. I mean, I didn't have any plans or anything like that, but I did like the other system. And there was nothing wrong with this one. It basically was like a benevolent dictatorship, which sometimes can be more effective than when you have a very democratic process, and therefore it may become tedious, and sometimes to arrive at a decision may take longer time than if you have something detailed from the top. So it depends on the mentality, but I still like that way, the way I propose.
Who were the guardians of the old way?
I don't like to name names.
Okay.
The people who have more seniority, let's say.
Okay.
I should take that back, because there were some with a lot of seniority, but didn't get involved at all in the department.
Oh, I see.
They were more concerned with their publication and their research.
How big was the department at this time?
Basically the same size now. I would say 25 faculty members. Yeah.
Excuse me.
There were many more grad students at that time than now.
So by 1980, you came in 1976.
76.
By 1980 or the early 80s, would you say that the department had changed and had become more
democratic? Well, by that time, the way things were done had changed, yeah. The new faculty have been hired, not many, but it was more diversified. And that was the beginning. You could see some of the members were either ready to retire or about to retire. So it was like a transitional time.
Now, in terms of enrollment, by the early 80s, is Spanish taking off in terms of popularity among undergraduates?
Well, but I think Spanish in this department was always large. They were probably in influx more in the late 80s of students from other departments, political science, international studies, sociology, even from engineering, that they wanted to take languages, not necessarily literature. They wanted the language. Also, by that time, there were more students coming from Latin American countries who were in the university, and to get an easy A, they will take the advanced language courses. So that inflated a little artificially the enrollments. But the enrollments at the undergraduate level, they were always very large. The only thing that I believe has declined is the enrollments of the, and there is a reason for that, of the graduate students.
And what was the reason?
Well, because in the 70s, 60s and 70s, the major departments of Spanish and Portuguese in the country produced a lot of PhDs. These PhDs went to other universities, universities who not necessarily had a graduate program. But that group of people create graduate programs, or were the force behind the creation of graduate programs all over the country. And therefore, there were more graduate programs and a pool of prospective or future students of Spanish who have a wider choice and a wider possibility to go to other universities. Therefore, the original major universities start fighting for those few ones. And also, it is the time also in which certain areas of study, engineering, for instance, were very, you knew this, you finished, you immediately got a job, not necessarily in the humanities. So it was a decrease also of good students who were thinking of majoring in the humanities, in modern language, or whatever. And that happens not only in Spanish, French, and German, I think, in all the modern languages. The same phenomenon.
Interesting. Now, I have to ask you about the department in terms of Spanish and Portuguese. Was there any kind of split between the professors of Portuguese and the professors of Spanish?
No, because the Portuguese department was very small, and basically it was, there were, I believe, two members only, and they were part of that group of original graduates from Wisconsin. There has never been any problem of that, no.
Has the Portuguese component grown over the years?
On paper, yes. Now there are four faculty. When I came, there was basically one and a half. No? Mm-hmm. But as far as number of graduate students, no. Undergraduates, it depends, because there are more courses now. Uh-huh. But the courses, there are more classes, but there are not really more students. What happens is the same class is named two different names. It depends whether the students in that class do the work in translation or in Portuguese. It's a kind of a gimmick to push to the deans the need to have an extra faculty.
Interesting. This concludes side one of tape three. This is side two of tape three, Emeritus Professor Juan Temprano. Before I leave the subject of Portuguese, is the language becoming more popular as Brazil becomes more and more important in the world?
This is only my opinion. I don't think so. Even though Brazil is much more important, I don't see an increase of students going in that direction. It's always been funny. The Portuguese always have had a lot of, and that is outside of this department and this university, Portuguese and Brazilians have had always an interest in Spanish, but the Latin Americans have had very little interest in Portuguese. In fact, in Brazil, I think there are more students of Spanish. I would say three times more students of Spanish than all the Latin American and Spain together of Portuguese. That's the way it worked. I mean, I don't know.
It's
a sociologist probably will have the answer, or an anthropologist, but and that's my impression. I don't have any statistics to corroborate that.
Well, returning to the department, you served two terms as chair. Let's see, 1990 to 93, and again 1996 to 2000. It's unusual to find a faculty member serving as chair twice. So I'm wondering if you could tell how it was you became chair the first time, what the issues were while you were chair, and then how it was you became chair a second time, 3 years later.
Well, in our department, like I believe in everyone, you are elected. There is every single year there are elections, even when you are chair. Uh-huh. And at that time, I was you had to be nominated by somebody, and second by somebody else in the department. There's an election, and I was elected.
Did you run for it?
Well, you have to agree to serve. If you're elected, you have to agree before the nomination take place. And I agreed to do that because my idea is if you're going to complain or want to do things differently, you had to jump into the fire. No? Uh-huh. At that time, I didn't want it to become a chair, and I was elected. By a full majority, yeah, but with objections.
Uh-huh.
I was elected with a unanimous decision, let's put it this way. And these first 3 years, there were times where I was able to convince the deans to get new faculty. In fact, now, most of the faculty right now, they were hired either during my first term as chair or my second time as chair. But that was also the time, the circumstances. There have been a lot of retirements, or retirements very soon to happen, and they didn't give us those positions. Now, the first time it was rather rough because the dean was new. Cronon had stepped out of the deanship after many years, and there was a new dean that was here only 2 years of my 3 years of a chair.
Was that Don Crawford?
That was Don Crawford, and I thought he was an excellent person, an excellent administration. It was from the philosophy department, and I thought he had a very analytical mind to cut through the, let's say, the garbage and see what the problem was, and very fair. Those 2 years, they were there was quite good, the relationship. The last semester of the second year, basically, he had announced he was going to leave to Santa Barbara. Uh-huh. I don't know why. I mean, there are rumors and so forth, but those are rumors, and therefore. Anyway, he was replaced by another dean who basically the humanities in our area of languages didn't count. So I don't think I met him twice in the whole year. The whole academic year.
Was that then Crawford Young?
That's right. Uh-huh. Yeah.
He was acting.
He was acting, right. Uh-huh. But he was acting, but he was de facto dean.
Yeah.
So that was a year of limbo, and very little could be accomplished. And basically, it was hard. It was hard also for many things, because when I became chair, there were no favoritism there was a tendency among the faculty to like to teach only twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, or Mondays and Wednesdays. And I didn't believe in that. I couldn't do it, but I had the support of enough faculty that teaching in the language department should be at least 3 times a week. Because for doing it twice a week, you have an hour and a half of class. Contact.
Mm-hmm.
2 periods of 1.5. Now, the students tend to get tired, so I do believe you accomplish less than if you divide it into 3 different periods. Also, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, for graduate courses, also, the graduate students have to teach undergraduates, basic languages. So, if you do an hour and a half, you cancel 2 periods to be able to assign those graduate students. Mm-hmm. Do I explain myself?
You do.
Yeah. So from the administrative point of view, and also from the, what I think, pedagogical point of view, I think that's the way it should have been done. And it was done that way. That also didn't set well with some of the faculty. Besides, by having Tuesdays and Thursdays, you have like Friday, Saturday, Monday off for the students who we all have been students, and you tend to leave things to the last moment. So, so I didn't think pedagogically was very good. So that was one of point of contention. Another was, until then, many faculty take off and came and went, and, you know, for a conference or whatever, and the deans have, at that time, request that people had to ask for a leave of absence, I mean, for a leave, permission. Yes. It was, we used to call it, may I? And they tend to, the class had to be filled with somebody. And some of the faculty used to put in a graduate student there. Well, I didn't believe in that either. I think you find a colleague who takes over and then reciprocate in the future. Another problem at that time also was giving the finals. The finals, there is a rule in the university, you cannot give finals the last week of the semester because you put undue pressure on the students. You had to give it on the day assigned. So many of the faculty didn't want to do that. They did it on the last day, on the last week, so they could take off right away. Well, in the, that I also got my foot into that kind of a practice that wasn't seen very, it's a very, it was not welcome, that type of.
You were, all three of those issues are quite contentious and
well,
difficult.
They're contentious, and the funny thing is that for a while they worked very nicely, and I think right now they are back to that. Now they teach twice a week, besides the reduction of courses. At that time, as I think mentioned before in our previous interview, we all used to teach three and three,
yes.
But now they teach two and two.
Yes.
And they have gone back to the Mondays and Wednesdays or Tuesdays and Thursdays. And, well, they don't give finals in the last week. They give a paper. They ask for papers. And, yeah, you can do that. But an undergraduate, it's good to ask for papers during the semester, but it's a means of evaluation to see how much they have learned during that semester is very doubtful, especially today with the new technologies. You don't know where those papers come from, what kind of resources they are using, and I'm not trying to put down the undergraduate. I'm just saying that that is not...
They need an exam.
I think an exam in that type of level is necessary. But there is my opinion, and there are other people, and I respect the opinion of other people. But that was the way to go around that problem.
So I take it, though, in your first term, you were affected in getting those three changes.
Yeah,
through.
But I think I lost about 5 years of my life. In fact, one of my colleagues took me to, what you call that, wrote a letter to the university committee complaining about my way of administering the department and accusing me of all sorts of things. And that was one of the hardest moments in my life here in the university because I was called in front of the university committee.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
They respond to a disgruntled faculty?
To a disgruntled faculty without any proof whatsoever. I did present all of them, every allegation, I answer in writing, almost in very legal terms. Then I went in front of the hall. I believe there were something like 50 members. They never even introduced themselves. I didn't know who I knew it was the university committee, but I didn't know who they were. I was almost like, I felt like a criminal answering questions they already have in writing, my answers. To make a long story short, after a week, I received a copy of the letter the university committee sent to that disgruntled faculty saying there was no reasons, there were not any reasons any reasons behind or what he was alleging I have committed, and therefore they dismissed the whole case. But all what I got, it was a copy of that in the bottom saying CC Temprano, my last name. No my first name, no my position, nothing. And I still have that letter. I thought that was very, very poor. The deans were aware of that. They always say, oh, don't worry, blah, blah. But they never supported any side. The other member was a long-standing member of the department with a lot of seniority, with a lot of contacts, married to another faculty with a lot of contacts. And I was, at that time, I was ready to leave university. But then things cooled down.
That's quite astounding that there was no support from South Hall for a department chair.
That was precisely at that moment in which, had it been Crawford Young still there, I think I would have. It was that year of limbo.
When Crawford Young was the acting dean. You think Don Crawford?
Don Crawford.
And you had to submit, well, it's just you had to submit.
I felt like a criminal going in front of a tribunal. Well, tribunal, no, in this case it was 50 members.
Almost sounds like the Spanish Inquisition.
They were more fair at that time. They were documentation and everything, in spite of what people think. and the archives are there to prove it.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Was it intense enough that you actually did seriously entertain leaving?
Yeah, I did. At that moment, yes, I did. I was, in fact, I was a finalist for chair at the University of Wisconsin Milwaukee. Because at that moment, it was at that position, and I didn't get it. No.
I get the sense from others of your colleagues that I have talked to that generally being a chair is a hard job. It is not an easy job.
Yeah, it's not not very grateful job. I mean, nobody will give you ever thanks for doing anything. Yeah.
But I take it you were successfully reelected for 3 years.
Well, I was. Do you mean for the second time?
No, I mean each year.
Oh, yeah, each year. Well, yeah, but each year with... It was not unanimous, neither one of the 3 years.
But I'm kind of impressed that you would take on those issues, particularly about teaching 3 times a week as opposed to 2, because that was going to annoy a lot of people.
Well, yeah, it did annoy a lot of people, but I thought it was important. I mean, let's face it, we are not biochemistry, we are not engineering, we are not going to discover the gunpowder or do revolutionary things for the good of the society. We are a very self-perpetuating department, and our mission basically is teaching. And teaching culture and the language, which is, they go together, of another people. And what you want is just to fulfill. And another contention was the number of hours, office hours, too, and to be there in the office hours. But
and so I assume.
And of course, you cannot be a guard, a policeman, just going around, but and check those things. But students came and complained, and you had to also defend the students' positions, no?
Now, was there any sort of informal association of all the chairs of foreign languages?
Yeah, there was, and I believe it still is, the associate dean for humanities used to meet with the, once in a while, with the foreign language people. Then the chairs of the foreign people also met, like, once a semester or so. But usually those meetings were, in my opinion, a waste of time. Because everybody said, went there to see what is here for me. I mean, I remember the last meeting I used to have, it was how to maintain enrollments in German and French when the Spanish department were, and one of the suggestions was to eliminate, not to allow students to take Spanish 101 or 102 or 203 or 204 because they already have taken in high school. or they have taken some Spanish, so they should be able to take another language. The only way to do that is to deny the Spanish department to have that. And that way, sometimes they did have a little support from the dean's office, but then they realized they couldn't do that, and it wasn't done. But that was not, that was this type of things what you discussed there. I wasn't very interested in. I don't know what they discuss now.
That's interesting. I remember even hearing when I was at the UW Foundation that Spanish enrollments were just dramatically increasing, and there was resistance from French in particular. Yeah. So you had to deal with that issue.
Yeah, a little bit. But basically, at the end, those decisions were done by the dean's office. So but when you have a lobby, and of course, with the friends who were the other departments who have very little enrollments, also the class sizes, the teaching, the teaching amount for faculty, because in some of the language departments, when we used to teach 3 and 3, yeah, but our 3 and 3 were up to the top, and some of the languages, they have 3 students, 4 students. Even though there were rules, they had to have a minimum of 20. Well, you know.
And how large could a Spanish class be?
Well, the classes have been always kept at a very decent number. 22, I believe, is the maximum.
Interesting.
But then when you had that many, that was the problem, how to staff those classes. That was another problem. And you don't have... At the beginning... The first few years, all the faculty taught languages. I think we talked about that subject. Now, neither one of them does. They consider that beneath their intellectual requirements. And it's in the hands of graduate students, but there are not that many graduate students, so they hire a lot of people from other departments who can speak Spanish. And then they give them like a 2-week, or I think it's a week, kind of a workshop, and they're in the classroom. One semester yes, one semester no. You know, just.
Now, when you were chair, did you have a further reduction in your teaching load?
Yeah, you have one course per semester. Uh-huh. Yeah, and the associate chair had one per year. Yeah. So I taught one class on.
Now, you were talking about hiring a lot of faculty, particularly in your first term.
The second term I also hired a lot.
When you were looking at the applicants, were you generally impressed with the quality of applicants that were coming for faculty positions? Were you pleased?
Let's say if we have one position, there will be 40 applicants. More or less, 20 automatically was discharged, either because of the qualification or because they were applying for a position they didn't have the background. I mean, we specifically, you had to announce what are you looking for and so forth. So 20 just because on paper, nothing. Mm-hmm. Then the other, usually for every applicant we have five very good contenders. Mm-hmm. And of course, the same were for the University of Michigan and for University of Illinois. And so sometimes we were basically fighting for the same candidate.
Interesting.
And that was the reason why, like, faculty salaries, especially in the upper ranks, didn't go up much. The assistant professor level, if you look at the statistics, they are very comparable to the... or even better than many other institutions. Not only that, after the 80s, the deans and that, they were very generous, so they got not only very good entering salary, but guaranteed 2 summers of research money without being not prejudicial, so that means that they could apply for it in the future, those 2 didn't count. So they came with a package of the salary, better salary, 2 summers warranty, and that was the beginning of the computers. And they got the latest computer, while the rest of the faculty at that time, we didn't have computers. I still remember as a chair the first time using like a 7 or 8 year old computer.
But I take it you supported that university decision.
That was good. But every year, you know, the new one they want to do, they want the most to give back the least.
Can you identify some of the good hires from that time period?
I think all of them, I don't want to individualize, but I think all of them were very good.
Uh-huh.
In fact, not a single case has been denied tenure. The last two I hired, they were granted tenure, I believe, the last Wednesday.
Good. So now, I'm curious, any hires similar to yourself, natives of Spain, who then studied in the United States?
Yeah, there has been one from Harvard, that got the PhD from Harvard. Very similar background to mine. He got tenure last year, but there is also from Argentina. There's one from Poland.
From Poland?
Yeah.
Huh.
One from Mexico. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. So you stepped down as chair in 1993.
Right.
And I take it maybe with a sense of relief?
Oh, yeah, very much indeed. And that was my first, right after was my first sabbatical. Because when I came here, there were no sabbaticals either. The sabbaticals were created the last 3 years, I think, of Cronon. And they were not automatic sabbaticals. They were, you had to apply, you still have to apply. But now it's a fait accompli, you know, you apply and you have been here 6 years, every 6 years you get it. At that time, there were only a few, he created a few. And I have been here 10 years already, and I applied, I was not granted. Nobody in my department was granted one.
Oh.
So my first one, that was when it was more relaxed. It was after being chair. I got a sabbatical finally.
And now?
Now the new ones, all the new faculty from the first time I was chair, all of them have had sabbaticals. Some of them 2 sabbaticals, 3 sabbaticals. That's another thing that has changed drastically.
Did you get that sabbatical partly as
a reward? No, it was because already I have had so many years, and now the sabbaticals were granted. And what the dean used to do, it was depending on the size of the department. Every department, our department had 2 sabbaticals. 2 members of the department could get per semester, so 4 in the year. No, right. So what you did, it was with internally in the department, you apply to the chair. The chair presents that to the secretary committee. If there are more than 2, there is a ranking. Those are presented to the dean. The dean makes the decision.
Oh, I see. Okay. Did you study in Spain that year, or did you stay here?
I went to Spain, and yeah, I went to Spain, and that was when I finished the 2 volume of the publication.
Okay, yeah. And we'll get to that when we talk about your research.
Yeah.
So, you worked quite hard as chair. You had a year off, you had a year sabbatical.
And no, a year, a semester.
Just a semester.
Yeah.
So, you have a half a year.
Hmm.
And then 2.5 years later, you're chair again. How did that happen?
Okay. After me came another chair for 3 years. And I was in Spain at that time. I believe it's because I was the director of the undergraduate program in Madrid.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed like I may have the days confused, but I was not here. I was not present in Madison. So when time came to elect a new chair, there was no agreement as to who that could be or whatever. By that time, Phil Sutton was the dean. So he called the associate professors of the department, which at that time they were more almost than the full professors.
Uh-huh.
And they were the new members of the department. I mean, the new quote unquote. And so he asked then what further advice. And I understand that was my, they unanimously recommended that I should be appointed chair. So when I came back, I found in my mail a note from the dean saying that he wanted to see me. So he called me and said, well, this is the situation. And I thought about it for a couple of days, and I said, with one condition. I'm not going to go through the, either you appoint me, or I don't want any new vote elections, you know? Because I knew certain of the full professors would say no. Uh-huh. And I didn't want to go through that thing again. He told me he couldn't do that. According to the rules of the university, at least you had to go through the motions. Even if I is negative, he can do that. He can appoint me, but he has to go through the motions. Okay, so somehow I liked him from the very beginning.
Oh, you liked him?
Yeah, I think Phil Sartin was one of the most effective and wonderful deans this university has had. On the basis of my experience. So I accepted. And we went through the course of 3 years again. There were new hirings. And between the third and the fourth year, there were at least two positions we have not filled, but they were in the making. And he asked me if I could stay one more year.
Wow.
That didn't particularly came very good with some of the members of the department. So I stayed a fourth year, and in that election I got 5 no's out of 20. 5 people saying no, but anyway.
This concludes side 2 of tape 3. This is tape number 4, side 1 of the ongoing oral history interview with Emeritus Professor of Spanish Juan Temprano. March 21st, 2007. Continuing with your second tenure as chair, were your initiatives from your first period of chair, teaching 3 times a week, more office hours, when exams were given, were those still in effect?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That,
and there was no move to change that?
Well, there was always moves to change or to avoid that. And there were always loopholes, and but on paper, in theory, yeah, you did still to the very end.
Was it easier being chair the second time?
Yes and no, because another thing of contention in the second time came up, and it was the problem, the eternal problem of salary raises. The deans. Well, as you know, the legislature first approves something for raises. Then the administration decides other things, decides how much the departments get and how it should be. And every year changes. The rules change every year, how that money is going to be distributed. Well, some of the faculty, when I communicated that, because the chair basically is nothing but a go-between, South Hall and the rest of the departments. So the problem was every year there was contention as to the division of these races. Sometimes there is a minimum that goes across the board. The deans were very much against that, and then the rest was merit. But how do you evaluate merit? And that was one of the problems.
Yes.
So that, in the past, well, before I became chair the first time, it was the chair with a group of people decided. We never knew, you know. After I was chair, it was decided that each one will rank the other. So I will rank the other 90 members, everybody will rank it, and then you computate that and you came out with a number. That was not necessarily very fair, because how do you evaluate? What is more important is an article you have published, or your classes, and your classes, your teaching. But how do you evaluate the teaching? On the basis of what? The evaluations? That's another kind of worms, because evaluations can be computerized and with numbers, but what do they mean? Is the article that you didn't publish this year but come out next year. And this year was a lot of money to divide, but next year there was none. There's many things, many problems, and nobody ever was happy. So the second time, I said, okay, fine, let's do a committee, a budget committee. Okay, the budget committee in the department representing all the areas. And first, that person meets with the people in the area, and they come up with a recommendation. Then the budget committee meets and polish a little bit the recommendations or takes a look to make sure this is fair. Mm-hmm. And then it's presented to the executive. So it couldn't be any more democratic, but not necessarily more fair, because it's very difficult to. And also keep in mind that in order to give, I always say that, in order to give it to Jan, you had to rob it from Peter, mm-hmm. because you don't have extra money. Mm-hmm. It's not like everybody gets four, and then we have here an extra amount to divide to the stars. No, we don't have that. We have a certain amount in everybody, and sometimes the amounts were ridiculous, like 2% raise, mm-hmm. less than the inflation.
Yes.
And that created more animosity than anything. So that was one of the problems of that. I assume it's still the same problem in every department.
Mm-hmm.
Then another wrinkle into that is that the administration began to make counter offers. When somebody had an offer from outside, well, that counter offer, at least under Phil Certain, it was done in such a way that part of this counter offer came from the raises of the department. Okay?
Oh, so the dean would take some of that money.
Yeah, he had a formula. so much the deans, so much the this, so much the that, and so on. So that was very nice. What happened is that ever since it was created, that type of system of answering outside offers, people were more concerned to get outside offers than to do the thing. And outside offers, I think things have gotten even worse right now. You don't even have to get, I understand, I have heard, because I don't have direct knowledge, but that last year they were without an offer, just with a university will write and say, could you, we're interested in, your name has been suggested, please apply to this position.
Mm-hmm.
With that, he was created what he was calling preempted offer. And some people got that. So suddenly, everybody has a letter from another university. All what you need is a friend in another a colleague who put your name on it. I think that's not very good for the university. I don't have the solution. Because some of them are real, you know. Some of them, I assume, that they wanted to take this wonderful chemist or this wonderful engineer or whatever, and it's up to the department. But I think it has been abused, that at least that's my view. Mm-hmm. So that creates, money creates a lot of animosity. That's the reason why I like, in certain way, the European system. It's not as fair, because in European system, you can be very lazy and still get the same raises than everybody else. But it's dictated by the government, your raises, and that's it. Hmm? Here is so-called the meritology, or merit raises and so forth. But that can create also many problems, or not being fair.
Did you spend a lot of time dealing with hurt feelings? Would faculty come and say, well, this isn't fair?
But the problem, they will never come and say that. They will be mad, but they will, you know, and everybody, nobody will tell me when I created this system, uh-huh. nobody will tell me that was unfair what it was done there. Everybody will say, I deserve more. But nobody will say, no, that was unfair. And I don't think it was unfair, believe me.
Uh-huh.
I think it was very carefully done. I spent hours and hours and hours on that. And many nights I didn't sleep, because almost foreseeing what will be the questions and the problems in the next meeting. And that, you know, after the 4 years, they say, no more. Yeah, I don't want to have anything to do with administration anymore.
Uh-huh.
I was burned, basically.
Yeah. And I suppose, even though you are the go-between between university administration and the department, because you are the one there, the unhappiness comes to you. It doesn't go to the dean.
Only when, you know, like in that case, went to the, all the way to the university committee, not even to the dean. It went to the university committee, which I thought the dean would be mad because they bypassed it. No. Yeah. No.
Before we leave the, your second term, you mentioned that you thought Phil Certain was an excellent dean. Part of the oral history interviews, I always do ask my subjects to evaluate the various deans they've served under. Do you have any additional perspective on Phil Certain as dean of the college?
Well,
was he supportive of foreign language?
Yeah, definitely. But he was supportive of everybody. It was no wishy-washy. I mean, he was a person who knew everybody by the first name in the college.
Really?
Who had regular meetings. You could see him any time of the day. He was there on Saturdays. I never seen anybody with a working as hard as he did. And also being a school and poised in every circle. I never saw him mad. Everything. He was a very optimistic person, even in the most difficult situations. He was willing to help if there's any problem in the department. In any given time, you could see him. As I say, his door was open, surrounded by a very effective group of staff. He had only, as far as I know, two. Between quotations, secretaries, both of them, one budgetary, one more academic, excellent. You feel comfortable going to the I had to meet with him several times for other committees. You know, I was in the Navy committee, small committee, so I got to meet him in different groups of 100 chairs and groups of 4 people and so. And always, I was very impressed. I was. When he stepped down for, I understand, family reasons, I really felt bad because I thought the college would never be able to replace a person like him.
That's quite a testament. Yeah.
No, I think it was. I think Dan Crawford could have been almost the same had he stayed.
I see.
He was in that, but I didn't get to meet to know him that well.
Now, when Phil was dean, Ivan Ozzello was associate dean for the humanities. Was that helpful to you to have a professor from the modern languages?
Not necessarily. But she was the most charming person, and I got along with her very well. And whenever I had difficulties with one colleague or whatever, she tried to help. She was very nice. I knew her from before, but I don't think she was partial necessarily to modern languages or anybody. I think she tried to be fair to everybody.
Yeah.
That has happened.
Any other observations about working with South Hall or being in academic administration?
Well, only one aspect that I don't know if it's just the timing or circumstances, and it's only I can judge from my department. And I don't know whether the administration has anything to do with that, but is the increase. When I came, there was the problem of former graduate students being faculty. But now what you have is a lot of faculty who were the spouses in the department in one way or another. And right now there are like 5, at least 5 or 6.
Wow.
The faculty who come, their wives are in the same field. So that was what Shalala remember. It was spousal retention and all these things. So they try to accommodate, and either they become visiting assistant professors and eventually this eternal staff member. And I don't think it's very good for the department. in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's good for that couple because they have a position,
mm-hmm.
and therefore two incomes. But let's face it, in the department who is running in a democratic way, there votes. So you have always two votes. They're going to vote together.
Yes.
But there are also issues that affect that particular group of people. And they are going to, their views are going to be colored by their situation. When I was a graduate student, and even the beginning assistant professor, I know many friends of mine whose wife teaches here and their husband there, because they couldn't, the universities didn't allow that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you didn't even have to be in the same department. Some universities didn't even allow in different departments.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe that the different departments I accepted. In the same department, I tend to see that as a very incestuous situation, and I don't particular favor, but that's my opinion.
You
know?
Mm-hmm.
And that has been, you know, from none to five cases now.
Now, you mentioned Donna Shalala, and again, before we leave administration, you were here through a number of chancellors. Irv Shane, I think, was chancellor when you came, and then
right.
That goes to Bernie Cohen, was acting chancellor,
I think so, yeah.
Then Shalala, then Ward, then Wiley.
Yeah.
How do you evaluate the various chancellors?
I don't think I can evaluate, because my information on that is basically like every other citizen,
mm-hmm.
the basis of the paper, and it's very difficult to know what transpired
mm-hmm.
there. I can tell you on a personal note that I didn't believe necessary in many of the things Shalala did.
Uh-huh.
But the others I cannot comment, because I don't have any really basis for comment.
Uh-huh.
You like it, you dislike it, and the basis, you have gone to a meeting in which they talk. I thought Ward was very efficient.
Uh-huh.
Rather ruthless, but efficient. But and also close to the faculty. I saw Shalala very distant.
Mm-hmm.
But that's...
This is just a sort of a question from left field. John Wiley's been very supportive of the School of Music because he seems
right.
to be
mm-hmm.
interested in music. Did you ever experience a chancellor who was particularly interested or valued the study of foreign language?
If they were, I was not aware.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no. And I it would be unfair for me to say anything, because it would be rather silly.
Juan, I want to redirect the interview now to the subject of your research and publications, aside from your teaching. If you could give us a review of what your program was when you came here, and what you worked on during your time here at the university.
So you went from the moment I arrived?
Right, yes.
Well, the first few years, I didn't believe in publishing for the sake of publishing.
Uh-huh.
What I have published to become associate professor, or to get tenure, I believe in what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I thought this. What I did was new and worth to publish. Thereafter, I maintained the same attitude. So that, together with the fact that all the problems in the department and so forth, I didn't publish as much as perhaps as I should have.
Hmm.
But I felt very comfortable. I took my time, and I did publish articles on new areas, especially on an important poet of the 13th century and a legal treaty of the 13th century, then a major work on a colonial writer, almost 1,000 pages. But it's not very prolific what I did. First, because, as I say, I didn't believe in just publish for the sake of putting another brick out that nobody read.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I have a friend, a colleague, who published a lot. And when I make a comment, or when I comment to him, oh, I have read this book, or this is very interesting, or this is failed to, in, you know, to get me involved, or whatever comment I make, his answer was, I don't have time to read, I only publish. And I didn't answer, but I thought, my God, how many of these are that they only publish? That means, to whom are they publishing? Everybody does the same. Mm-hmm. And let's be honest, what you publish in our areas is for your own colleagues, basically. Who else read that? they are very esoteric, very arcane subjects, and only the people who are involved in that care. Now, I even think people read less because they want to write something. They go into Google and they put, I don't know, let's say something, a subject that was very much in fashion in the late 90s, gender studies. Mm-hmm. And they will put gay or whatever, or lesbian authors, blah, blah. And they don't have to read that. They get the biographies, or they are directed to read this particular passage or that. And that's not the way it was formed. So I lost a little faith in the value of publication. Nevertheless, I did publish. I became full professor, and one of the elements are publications, and I kept publishing a little bit after. There was another reason. When I came here, I was very interested in my graduate students. And until the time I came here, most of the dissertation in medieval period, they were language-oriented. That means they will transcribe a manuscript and then do vocabulary, lexical studies, mm-hmm. of that text. That was most of the dissertation. When I came here, I didn't believe in that. I think there's space for that, but not everybody. So I insisted with my students that they will do literary studies, historical studies, cultural studies with those texts. That was hard to break with the tradition because there were some students and some colleagues that I had to deal with in that sense. So many times when I suggest to a new graduate student, to a new doctoral student, to write on something or to explore a possibility, sometimes I didn't know much about the subject. So I thought it was my job to know as much as he did, almost. So I used a lot of my time to study as much or to read or to become familiar with the readings and the text of this subject of dissertations. I never regret that because I grew. I learned a lot, uh-huh. And also I was able, during my period of, to me that's part of the research, to have about 15 graduate students who did a dissertation with me, uh-huh. And all of them are placed in very good universities, and all of them are tenured today. At least it's not all of them there.
Would you talk about who some of your graduate students, where some of them are, and some of the key ones are.
One is in University of Pennsylvania. Only one of the two graduate students from this department in an Ivy League school. One is in Vanderbilt. One is in Emory. One is in Indiana. One is in Ohio. So they are all of them are located in
top flight schools.
Very quite good schools, and all of them have obtained tenure. And so I'm very proud of them. When I retired, my first group of graduate students, seven, came together within 2 years. So it was like 7 years after I was here, basically they obtained their PhDs. When I retired, they surprised me coming home, and they have come from different parts of the country.
Oh, that nice. Means,
there's another thing, they got along beautiful. They still, to this day, they came from different parts of the country, and they have prepared dinner.
So
that was a very lovely And I keep in touch with all of them.
I was going to ask if you're in touch with them.
I keep in touch in whatever they publish or whatever. I don't write any more letters of recommendations, I told them. But because I think they don't need that anymore. They are on their own and they're very good. But with some of them, I have a relation almost like father and son, and father and daughter, or whatever.
You know. And I assume that you don't have any graduate students anymore.
No, I don't, the last 2 years, I told them I'm going to retire, so please select somebody else.
Uh-huh.
And if only one student didn't finish the dissertation. But funny enough, and you will think this, I'm making that up, but I'm not. This Monday, I received an email from her. It was a student who, in my opinion, shouldn't go on anymore.
Uh-huh.
And before writing the dissertation, I always told them they had to present a kind of a sketch of what they want to do, a 30-page, more or less, proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And that person was, time and again, the proposal was not good enough. So I told the person that what he should do is, since he had to follow the husband, also, he was married and had a baby already, and all this, that was the excuse always for the proposal not to be on time. He said, well, why don't you try to find your niche in a good high school or a junior college? Mm-hmm. He had already a master, was in ABD. Try to do whatever course the state requires, whatever classes, to become accredited to teach in a high school or whatever, and do that. I mean, that way you maintain the, you know, teaching what you like, and it's a source of income. Well, on Monday, I received a letter, an email from her. I haven't heard from her for about 4 years, thanking me for the advice and for being honest enough to tell her that it was not good enough, the proposal, and that finally that she followed the advice, taught in high school, and then finally she was able to get in a junior college a position. So that to me is more important, that plus my graduation is more important than anything else.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Because the publication, the only thing they do is keep dust in the libraries. Well, to be fair.
You're quite a realist, aren't you?
Well, you mean practical and realist? No, yes. Not practical, but realist, yeah.
Yeah. It's a compliment.
And I take it as such.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
When you look at your publications, and I think about when you were on sabbatical, what would you say is your most significant piece of work?
As I say, the problem is I don't know who reads that. And also sometimes they read it only to quote or to put a footnote.
Yes.
But what is the practicality? You're not asking me that. You're asking what is the significance. To me, it was very significant because I thought, when I did it, that I was saying something new about that text or that author. That was, to me, enough.
At the time that you did it.
At the time, and that's what it is still today, to this day.
Uh-huh.
If somebody has used that as a point of departure, well, I feel very, very happy and glad because it has helped somebody else to continue, or at least agrees with my view. So, but if it doesn't, really, I don't care.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe the reason of my being here on this earth is not to have published that. That's not the most proud thing that I am in my life. No.
Uh-huh. Did you, in terms of your scholarly work, anything that you like doing best?
I like the process more than the result. I like the process of reading one thing and taking you to read another thing and to find another thing. And so therefore, what I'm doing is enriching myself. Uh-huh. In that sense, I'm selfish.
Yes.
But that's the whole process. The result, Well, it's in paper, doesn't mean anything anymore.
Are you doing any research now in retirement?
Now the only thing I do is read, and read something completely different. Like, I'm reading a lot of biographies and modern history. And look, you know, something that's... Well, right now, I always read two books at the same time. I'm reading one by a professor from here, emeritus professor from the history department, Stanley Payne, a book they just published. He's a very prolific person, and very good historian. So I'm reading his last book on the Civil War. Mm-hmm. It's called 40 Fundamental Questions About the Spanish Civil War. He has the question, and then he has an essay answering, which I think is very revealing and extraordinary. It's very good. I'm learning a lot, even though I have studied the Spanish Civil War. But
are you learning things you didn't know?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
And the other one, I'm reading one of those historical novels, which is a little town in Catalonia, which the people decide to build a cathedral. You know, it's part of the tendency that began with Umberto Eco, the Italian author, with The Name of the Rose, that was the first historical novel that creates some kind of a genre, and now has been abused. This one, so far I'm not sure what I... It's about 800 pages. I don't know whether I will finish it. I think it uses all the clichés, but that's another story. But that's what I do. I'm not writing anything.
Uh-huh. Are you coming back? Are you invited in to do guest lectures at all?
In the department here? Uh-huh. No, in the department. One day you leave the department, goodbye, and that's it. I don't even get the programs or the events. I had to look. But that's that's the way it works. I got an invitation from a friend of mine who is a president of the university and wanted me to go there as a visiting for one semester. But it wasn't worth it to me. It's in New York. To leave the family and go there for one semester. For what?
This concludes side one of tape four. This is side two of tape four, Emeritus Professor of Spanish, Juan Temprano. When you look back on your 30 years here, I'm interested in your observations about the undergraduates coming through the department and the university. What they've been like, how they've changed, if they've changed, if you have opinions about what their level of interests are.
It's a little hard to say whether they have changed or not. One thing I have noticed, and I think is at least to me very prevalent and very obvious, it was an ever-increased concern with grades more than with the acquisition of a knowledge. But grades and to get top grades. But top grades do not just for the sake of that. Let's see if I explain myself. When I began to teach, it used to be that the C was average, a B was above average, and A was excellent. So if you have a person, a student, who had like a 3-point GPA, that was quite good. 2.8, 2.9, that was above average. But today, almost everybody is above 3.5. How? It's not possible everybody's excellent. And I don't believe it has been that change. Mm-hmm. I have my own theory about what has happened. If you remember, in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, it was the Vietnam War, and you had to maintain a certain GPA not to be drafted, mm-hmm. or not to be classified in a certain way. Mm-hmm. So a lot of faculty who didn't believe, in many universities, who didn't believe in the war, began to inflate grades, and that was the beginning, and they never stopped. and the grades were inflated. Many people got B's and S, who probably deserved C's and D's. But that became the norm. And almost now, I mean, look at the GPS of the, not in science, I'm talking about humanities and social sciences. Look at the history. I mean, that would be for some sociologists or whatever to study the grade point, the GPS in this college. Let's see what happens, what they were in 1970, what in 2005. And so that was an inflation of that. That was together with another thing. At around 1970, became a movement all over the country to evaluate the faculty. Before 1970, the students didn't write evaluation except in some Ivy League schools. They did evaluate these professors and they signed their names.
Oh.
And it was an essay type. But then they became, with the beginning of the computerized world, and they began this enormous list of questions, some of them absurd. Is the professor sensitive to your needs? And things like that. Anyway, so it became like almost a game of ping pong. The student knew that he had a weapon with the faculty to evaluate, because in theory, those evaluations were considered for tenure, for promotion, for raises, and the faculty acquiescent to that kind of relationship. Didn't want to have bad evaluations, so you kept giving the good grades. Now, this Bob, you may not agree with that. It may not be. I don't have any facts to give you. What I do believe, what I do know, is that your GPAs were much lower before than they are now. And I don't believe the students are any better today than they were before. There's no question that. So that has been a change, a drastic change. A student now, he doesn't get an A or an AB, you have him the next day asking why. And he doesn't say, oh, in my exam I missed this, could you explain? No, they don't care about that. They care about the grade. Why did you take me a point from this? Oh, I don't think it's worth a point. It's only half a point. No. This type of attitude, this minutia, which... Now, I don't say 100% of the students are like that, but I say that is the rather predominant situation. And just go around and look at the department's GPS.
Did you participate in grade inflation, or did you hold the line?
No, I hope I never did. In fact, I lost students because of I didn't do that. But I had to be honest. At the very end, there were some times I say, I don't care anymore, because I was one or two or three in the department who were maintaining certain standards. I was the only one, for instance, in graduate level giving Z's and B's. I'm sorry, I was not the only one. I was one of three who did that. And that was an honor. That student will never say hello to you anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
And so that, I would have to think, for a scholar like yourself, would wear you down.
Well, it would. What if it, it's not the word, you lose faith in the system a little bit. I mean, how is it? And you begin to question yourself. How is it that a student in my class does that, and I look at the grades of all the other classes that there is? Because that's what they will tell you. That's the first C I ever got. Well, what can I do? They never question that the exam deserved more. There was a C or a B or a BC. Also worked. It used to be A, B, C, D, F. Then they created the AB, the BC. It was a way of putting some kind of icing on a cake that was a little rotten.
Uh-huh.
Or a nice sauce and a piece of bad meat. You.
And I want to ask you a little more about student evaluations of professors. The subject comes up, and there's a variety of opinion among your colleagues that I interview.
Oh, yeah.
Are you generally opposed to that? Do you think there is some place for it? Do you think, and I think you don't feel this, but, you know, should they be, those student evaluations be given a lot of weight?
That's a very difficult question to answer. In principle, I will be in favor. But in principle, also, evaluations shouldn't have to exist. Because in principle, the faculty is supposed to be competent.
Yes.
And supposed to be pedagogical.
Yes.
Otherwise, how in the world was he hired?
Mm-hmm.
So, if the faculty fulfills the job, there's no reason to evaluate. I mean, it seems to me, if you are a worker in a factory and you you fulfill your job, you put your pieces together every day and you put the numbers they tell you, they don't evaluate you every day. If you don't do it, they fire you. So, I am reducing that putting it in very simplistic terms. But, you know, I don't have much faith in these evaluations which they get to do in 15, 20 minutes, the same week, everybody, the students are sick and tired of evaluation. And sometimes some of the students, they do make they answer carefully and so forth. Some of them, you never know. But how do you know the ones who do and the ones you know? You have in the same group of students, let's say you have 20 students in the class, and one said, he's the best professor he ever had. And the other one said, the worst professor. Which one do you believe? I realized that the statistical people say, well, we eliminate the top, we eliminate the bottom, we get to the median and so forth. But the meaning of all this is, even when they write, very rarely they take their time to write. They have an option to write a little general answer. There you find spelling mistakes, atrocious grammar sometimes. So who in the world is this person to evaluate me?
Yes.
Or to evaluate you? Another thing, evaluation. This country, right now, I think the Western world, loves evaluation, loves statistics, loves to have opinion of everybody.
Yes.
How many times you have been in a hotel and they is there, and you have felt that? When do you feel? Only when you are mad, no?
Mm-hmm.
I never feel one of those. Even when I'm mad, I don't. If I'm mad, I call the manager.
Yes.
Or I talk to the receptionist. I don't bother to do that. The student by... Yeah, they put it there. They have 20 minutes to do it. And... I don't know. It's fill A, B, C. You know, they have a question. Three options. You agree, you disagree. What does it mean? Okay, that... First, I don't believe very much in that. Then, from the other point of view, I do know that they are faculty. That they, 2 or 3 weeks before that, they are already promoting themselves. There's a little prostitution going on.
Mm-hmm.
And if they tell you it's not, believe me, it is. There is such a thing.
Catering to the students?
Oh, yeah. Especially in the... I don't believe that that takes place in science. In fact, many students take what is chemistry 225 or whatever, organic chemistry, they take it 3 and 4 and 5 times.
They take
it to the very end. When they are failing, they drop the course. And then they take it again, and they take it again. So they don't evaluate but one time, and I doubt they even bother to evaluate. Oh, I don't know what the engineers or the scientists think about those evaluations. I know there are prizes for good teaching and so forth. Well, what does it mean? I know in my department, one of the persons I consider the worst teacher got a teaching award. But that's my opinion. I've never been in her class, but I have been with her talking and interacting. And
is this evaluation phenomena as common in Europe as it is here?
No, in Europe, now they are beginning to copy this. They're beginning to do that. And what is the reaction? The first reaction is always the students... How do I get back to this guy or to this woman or to whatever? But they are beginning. I don't know how much weight or with any, because the system there is not. You know, again, we go back to the money that we were talking before. Their races are not predicated on that. I think evaluation itself is students. If they take another course with you or not, that to me tells you more than anything else. If they don't like your way of teaching, or they don't like you, they will never take a class with you anymore. That's fine. So if your enrollments are low, when all the other enrollments are full, given equal situation, no, given the same type of grading and so forth, it shouldn't be any... It tells you that, to me, it tells more than anything else. People who select you to direct a dissertation or to work with you or to do a senior paper.
Is it fair to say that you think it is probably not terribly difficult to evaluate professors, that it's not as complex as people suggest? You know who the good teachers are. You know who the good researchers are.
I think the faculty know that, yeah. But the question is, again, how do you do that? You will have to ask them to put it in writing, another, and you come out with another, oh, I don't want to hurt his feeling, or the opposite. Huh? Or I do want to destroy this bastard. You know, it's very difficult. That is the reason why it's very important, the selection process of hiring the person. And then there is a tenure period. Mm-hmm. And then there is an annual. Now they have like a review every 3-5 years.
Even after you're tenured?
Oh yeah, I mean from now on, that was created again because everybody lost evaluations. So there is a lot of bureaucracy built into that. Every 5 years now is what is called a post-tenure review. In this university, everybody has to go through that.
Did you have to go through that?
Oh yeah, twice. That was created, I don't know under what administration. But yeah, it was.
Who does that? Does the dean?
No, the faculty in your department. It's another bureaucratic process, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, this maybe is a good lead-in then to ask you to reflect on your time at the University of Wisconsin, whether you're glad you came, how you evaluate it. What's been good about it and what's not been good?
Oh, I think like everything else in this life, it have been great moments and very low moments.
Yeah.
In general, I think it has been everything very positive.
Uh-huh.
I think the best thing has been my relation with with most of my graduate students and some of the undergraduates. You get to know some. You are lucky enough sometimes. Mm-hmm. You are in your office and you follow them and so on. So in that sense, that is a, you know, you get a letter from, I still remember your classes or whatever. That is what makes you feel that you have accomplished something.
But
in general, it has been very nice. And also, I made a point of teaching everything from beginning to the super seminars, you know. There, the list is very, very reduced. I have many more. But for instance, I used to, sometimes to distract myself, I created courses. Like, in the very beginning, I used to teach a course for the medical students.
Oh, really?
Yeah, medical Spanish.
Uh-huh.
That, after I stopped, nobody wanted to do it, and now it's done, but they have given, I don't know, I'm not going to say anything about that. But I used to have a group of medical students second and third year. I used to teach that in the evenings. And that was very, very enjoyable. Because what I did, I created, at that time there were no books. Now there are like 15 books in the market or more.
Oh, and your father was a doctor.
Yeah, and my brother and my sister. And so I created like a normal situation. You get sick. You say, what are your symptoms, blah, blah, blah. This another chapter with medical history. Then you go to a hospital, and from admissions, I just went to see this hospital. I said, okay, first floor is admissions. What are the paperwork and so forth? This. What are the other one? Then the one, pediatrics. This. And so each chapter was dealing with one of those departments. So I enjoyed that, but I got tired because it takes a lot of work. These students, they were tired too because they have been in medical school and they are rough there. I mean, they had to study very hard. So when they came, they wanted to be entertained a little bit and more or less learn the language almost by osmosis.
Okay.
But I took it very seriously and, I got mad because they didn't study. But on the other hand, they were taking that class for naught, I did that. But then I did another one that it was very successful at a higher level for business students. And so I did that several times. In fact, the last two courses I taught the university were that. And it was with the very high support from the business school. The business school were fantastic. Very supportive, very... Anything I asked for, they gave it to me. You know, as far as I was one of the few ones from humanities teaching at their beautiful building. Well, at that time they have all the gimmicks, yeah. Electronics and you know, and all kind of technology and so forth. Help a lot. And those classes, I really enjoyed. They were mostly business students who were either they wanted to know Spanish too.
And did so, most of those kids or students come in with some elementary
yeah,
Spanish?
No, they have had this, yeah, they have, because this was the equivalent to the last year of language, to the junior language level. But instead of writing essays on literature or whatever, they would write papers and answer exams and so forth, and readings related to business. Uh-huh. And we did bank, stock market, a corporation, the different levels of a corporation. And so I had to learn a lot about that. In fact, I went to the University of South Carolina, for a summer course in business for prospective. In that time, it was the beginning of that. Now every university has one class of that. But
interesting. What is your opinion of, how do you see the future for the University of Wisconsin? Are you optimistic?
Oh, I think so. I mean, who am I to say? But seems I know about the future. What you know, what every citizen, educated citizen, know. They are always complaining about, and it seems to be a fact that the budget situation is the problem. That the government or the doesn't support proportionally as much as they used to. That's the reason why tuition keeps increasing. But I think the university. Different than politics in this country, that's another subject, has the people, enough wise people. Why, and I mean the word wise in the very authentic sense of the word, to keep the university going forward for many, many, many years. Because it's true there is a lot of, in my opinion, people who try to take advantage of the university, but there is a lot of dedicated people in the university, a lot of them, and very smart, very intelligent. The Phil Sertins, the Dave Wards, they will find a way to maintain the university going forward and every year better and better and better. I don't have any question that. I'm very proud. My children study here. I expect my grandchildren will study here. They, I don't know, depends on their parents, of course, what they want to. I think they're smart enough to make it. So I'm talking about what they want to come here. Is selfish reasons. I want to see them here and also close to me. But if they go someplace else, I assure this. No, the university, especially the graduate level in this country, is second to none. It's very good. And, in science, the only thing you have to do is go to science. More than half of the students, they are not from the United States.
Yes.
They are from outside, so something must offer to... They don't go to Europe, they come here. Mm-hmm. I mean, they go some to Europe, and no, mostly here. That is, I think, one of the problems. That less and less students are going into engineering, science, and so forth. Mm-hmm. That's fine. They should, all of them should learn 1, 2, 3 foreign languages if possible. But and they should be round and literate and educated in this basic sense. But it's too bad that I think this country in science is losing grounds.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what statistical studies have been showing, that there is a massification of education here.
Mm-hmm.
High school, everybody goes, why don't they go to technological schools or technical schools where they can learn skill? When you look at what is needed in this country, sometimes they need electricians, they need plumbers, but nobody goes, everybody wants to go to university. Well, and that's, not everybody can make it, but everybody makes it, and that's go back a little bit to the inflation. And of course, they have these wonderful humanitarian ideas of promoting diversity and all this. But to me, everything that is force is not necessarily good. And diversity is a force. They have these plans the last 10 years or more. Ever since, I think it was war at the beginning, the plan of 98, the plan of whatever. We have to have so many minorities here, so many this, so many women, so many men, so many left, so many right. One day they're going to say, so many brown, so many brown, so many under 6 feet. This is a little exaggeration of that. But okay. That's the old man is talking now.
A wise old man.
Yeah. No, the old man is talking.
This concludes the interview with the most accomplished and very engaging Juan Temprano. Thank you very much.
Oh, you are more than welcome.